All right, so we have, you know, the three amigos, if you will, from C++ and beyond. This is the end of the 3 days of a great event. I just sort of want to debrief you on how you thought it went and kind of your highlights.
I love their talks.
I love their talks.
Well, maybe that's a good idea, critique the talks of each other.
Well, we always like it better. We like the other people's talks better because we're not speaking at the time. So we just get to sit back and it's really easy.
Yeah.
So that's the best thing about somebody else speaking.
Well, and seriously, this is about the only time, even when we still had SD and other conferences, that we could actually get to hear each other's talks.
Yeah.
Because we're always, otherwise we're not at the same events or we're booked in separate rooms competing and never get to hear each other. Mm. And especially to hear new talks.
Like, yeah,
new material. I loved how you did the memory model.
Yeah.
Oh, because this is one of those things that used to be the domain of a priesthood. Only a few people doing supercomputers needed to know about memory models. Mm-hmm. And now anybody who wants to do modern programming and cares about performance has to know this stuff. And I like the way that you took this very difficult thing, broke it down, and presented it, because you're the master at that.
Thank you. I hope you filled out an evaluation for the talk.
Yes, there you go.
So, a funny thing, like... usually, like during a different talk at a run-of-the-mill conference, I would email, you know, do my email and kind of sit in the back, kind of hang out. But during Scott's talk, I was like, "Hey, let me close the laptop and actually watch because there's a lot to learn here." So
you got his attention.
Yeah, he definitely did.
He probably looked at me and said, "Yeah, that's wrong. That'll never work." So no, but I was going to say actually because I actually disagree with you about this whole business of everybody's going to have to know this kind of stuff. Oddly enough. My feeling about the whole business about the C++X memory model is that there's a lot of stuff there, but at the end of the day, the message is really, really simple.
Yeah.
Because it really is, if you follow the rules, you can ignore all of this stuff. It's just that C++ programmers have this business, they want to push at the walls and scratch at things and look under the carpet, and it's only after they've satisfied their curiosity that okay, I really don't need to go there, and that you know things are designed reasonably, then they can kind of settle back and go, okay, I'm not going to worry about it. And so that's my attempt.
That's fair because that kind of knowledge helps you debug a really nasty bug,
and inevitably
those are going to happen. You know,
you drew an interesting diagram of C++ programmers.
Oh, yeah.
And then you can hold it up and he can zoom in and people can see what you're doing.
So my experience here is that, you know, so when you describe a new feature, and I'll show this to the camera in a minute, you describe a new feature to C++ programmers, you sort of say, okay, look, this is the design space of the new feature. So this is where we want to be able to sort of do things in this feature. And then after you've described that, you say, so are there any questions? And immediately people say, all right, what happens right here on the edge? What happens right here on the edge? Well, now what happens if you push this boundary a little bit here?
Can I get beyond the edge over there a little bit?
Nobody ever cares about what's going on in the middle because they know that stuff's going to work. That's not the interesting stuff. So, you know, this is why we have questions about, you know, the consistency model. Well, now, is it just loads that have to not move? Or what about stores? And, you know, what if they're ordinary variables? So, that's my experience with dealing with programmers is that they want to know this stuff.
They want to know how it works.
That's right.
And isn't that, in some sense, the power of C++ in the first place? Is it lets you get to the edge. And you can cut your legs off, but it lets you get there.
Yeah. It's important to be able to do what you need to do in a simple, clear way. And we talked about this at the beginning. There's a happy path through modern C++ where you have a lot of the productivity of other modern languages. It's not your granddaddy C++. Mm-hmm. You get auto, which is like C# var. You get lambdas, which are pretty easy and cool, and some of the syntax looks identical to C#'s, and things like that. And yet, you get also the power to go down to the bits if you need to, and do stuff that you just can't get to otherwise. And these people want to know, how do I use this nice part 90% of the time, but when I need to, I want to know how it works so that I can rearrange the engine and put in a new filter or, you know, turbocharge it a little bit when I need to, and you can. So
sure. Now, Andre, I mean, this is called C++ and beyond, and you are one of the D language designers, along with Walter Bright, and I believe Bartosz is also doing some things with you guys.
Some, yeah.
But mainly you and Walter. Why?
Why D when we have C++?
Well, let me ask. It's an honest question. I mean, it's a
good question. For one thing, let me position D in relationship to C++. So my honest belief is that C++ is so enormously entrenched and so established and so successful, that I think it's, you know, no language is going to effectively just dismantle it, and just essentially replace it off the landscape of programming languages. So that's pretty much a given. And for that reason, I think it's there's no sense of threat either from, you know, from this viewpoint from C++ or vice versa. We started and are working on the deep programming language because we believe there is a need for a language that uses C++ as the 2020 rear vision, right? The 2020 vision understands the good parts and the not so good parts from C++ and from experience with other languages as well, and sort of builds a best of the breed language that that essentially does everything the right way, with much fewer compromises and much more a much better reflection of the progress that has been marked in these decades in the theory and practice of programming languages. I do believe that D has a very strong offering to make for either an existing C++ programmer and also programs coming from other languages such as interpreted languages. But at the same time, it's understood that C++ is not going to be replaced. It's an enormously successful language. C++ 11 is going to continue building on that success, and that's a good thing. And having D is also a good thing.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
If you, this is a variant of the question I asked you the other night, but it, not so much about what are the top three reasons to use D, or top three reasons to use C++, which. First of all, the fact that you answered those right off the cuff both ways shows you that you understand the problem. Because you also, you've got to know what your product does and what it doesn't do, which is great. But let me ask you from a C++ and beyond point of view, we want to learn things from other programming languages. So from what you've learned and seen in D, what are the top two or three features that might come to mind that D has that
I wish
that C++ could have? Like, there's nothing that there's nothing in it that's inherently prevents you from having the feature that you would like to see in C++.
Right. Well, I mentioned one during the Q&A session just half an hour ago. So one big thing is static if, which just for the benefit of our users, essentially it's a pound if on steroids, hash if on steroids. So it would be a sort of an if state, you know, meta statement that's integrated with the language that can test any statically compilable expression and would either compile or not a specific block of code. And it turned out that this is a very simple, very easy to implement feature. In either C++ or D, it's not a difficult feature at all. And it has an enormous impact on the ability to write solid generic programs. That would be one. So static if is absolutely the top of my list of things I wish they were in C++. And second, I'm thinking of template constraints. We have followed with a great deal of interest the evolution of the ultimate demise of concepts in C++.
Not demise. Still being worked on.
Okay, not yeah. No demise.
But yes, so they didn't make
the evolution and let's say the setback of C++ concept. So while watching that, it became clear to us, to Walter and myself, it became very clear that we gotta have something that fulfills the, you know, that.
Oh, good.
That actually does the job. But at the same time, we understood that some of the restrictions that the creators of this feature in C++ have imposed to themselves that essentially forced them to build a very complicated feature. So the way we went with a very lightweight approach, which essentially allows you to use the same underlying facility as static if to qualify a template. So you can say, for example, I want to define this function for all arrays as long as the array has an integral type as the element type. So you can define a function and then you say if, at the end of the function definition, just before the opening brace, you get to say if the array type, element type, which is a template argument, satisfies this compile time condition. And essentially with this, which took literally a week to implement, it was very easy to implement because it builds on the same backend as static if. With this feature alone, it was a huge success. It essentially allowed us to have concepts at virtually no cost, either to the user, because anybody who sees that says it sees you see a class or function definition, and you have an if qualifying it. And if the if fails, it disappears, it vanishes off the map. Mm-hmm. So essentially all the difficult overloading problems are avoided from the get-go. You just have an if that qualifies the whole thing. You know, enable if on steroids, you know? So that makes a lot of things much simpler.
That's what you always do, is take difficult template things and make them even more advanced, and put them on steroids.
Well, but this is actually a language change.
Yeah, this is a language change.
I realize that.
Actually makes a lot of things that are complicated, unduly complicated, it makes them very simple. I wish that would be my second top, you know, second most wish, you know, best wish to have in C++.
I just want to say a couple of things that I like about D is that I get a chance to look at it and go, well, that's a really interesting decision. You know, for example, templates don't really look, for one thing, they have a simpler syntax, but also the idea that a function that runs during compilation doesn't have to look syntactically different from a function that runs at runtime, which is just a really clean idea.
Right.
But actually, my favorite thing in D, just in terms of a conceptual decision, I really like the idea that memory by default is thread local.
Yeah,
and so basically the default is not shared, which is this really simple decision, and it has all these other ramifications. And so I that's the kind of stuff I like about D. So I kind of go, oh, that's a really interesting idea.
That has actually a funny story behind it. I remember I was working against a number of deadlines, finishing my doctorate. You know, I was getting employed by Facebook at that point, in late 2009. And I was to set in stone the threading model of D. Essentially
what
alone.
Was that all?
So it was, we had the kid too.
And you had a baby.
So it was, let's say,
name, as far as I can tell, is
the kid. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it was a fateful time, okay? And I essentially had 2 months in my lab to define this approach to threading that would definitely influence the entire rest of the language and its evolution. And I took this decision. It was a high-risk, high-reward decision. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know what, we're going to go the Perl way. Perl did the same thing, but it failed for different reasons, because it being an interpreted language, you would have to duplicate a lot of state whenever it would create a new thread. D did not have that problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, this is a really clean model in which, what is a good default when you start a new thread? Well, you don't want to share. Best sharing is no sharing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And next best sharing is little sharing.
Mm-hmm.
So you want by default to have this model in which data is separate for each thread, and occasionally threads choose to communicate. And you know, we define this model in which there's no implicit sharing. It's as if threads were processes. But then we have the shared qualifier, which allows very controlled, very principled, and very well-organized systematic sharing of memory. And I'm very happy now that I made that decision.
I like people who solve problems by saying, let's just make the problem go away, rather than, you know, we've got a problem, let's add a bunch of solutions. And so D just says, okay, we know there's a whole bunch of disadvantages associated with people accidentally having races and stuff like that. So let's just make that impossible.
Yeah.
What a great idea.
Right. Well, Scott, truth be told, just a second, truth be told, the no shared by default model is more restrictive.
Mm-hmm.
So in that model, you would need to rely more on message passing for communication, which is safer, but it can be occasionally slower.
Mm-hmm.
So there are trade-offs to be made there, and occasionally you would need to say, well, the current offering does not allow me to share certain patterns and certain topologies of data. So you need to, for example, look at casting away shared and taking your life in your own hands and doing your own locking or non-locking, you know, lock-free algorithms, but I believe that this is a good engineering decision to leave the difficult decisions to people who really know about it, and just let the default path, the path of least resistance, be the safe one.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is an excellent example of where language innovation and trying things out in other languages or in C++ benefits C++, because all languages borrow from each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the old borrow versus steal. quote.
Right.
And in this particular case, so much of what has benefited Java and C# and C++ has been taken from languages that are so dissimilar, they're not even imperative, and yet look how they're helping.
And absolutely.
It's so important not to be a bigot, because if you're a bigot, you see like this, and you only ever want to see like this, and there's a big world out there. Yeah. And you want to learn from what's going on. And having a simpler language to try these things out in actually is helpful. You can prototype faster. You said it was a big risk with big reward. It was an enormous risk. I was glad you were doing it, because I wanted to see how it would turn out. Because D is not the first. It's by no means the first language to try to immutability by default. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, functional languages have done that. There's the pure ones, and there's the ones people use, you know, that old one. And then have tried to do thread local unshared by default. But then Perl has done it one way, and others have done it other ways. And here you were trying a new approach, a new wrinkle to it. It's not just the same old. Mm-hmm. But it's very risky, because nobody really knows, especially not even a very bright person in 2 months in a lab. Nobody knows what the consequences are of that in a million line code base.
Right.
And the only way to find out is for somebody to be brave enough to go try and then find out, okay, does it work, or where are the parts it works well? What are the things how does it change your programming style? Are there any things that it lops off that are important and you run into a dead end? Or is it a bright, shining path? Nobody can presume to really answer those questions from a paper design or from an idea in their head. Most people do that. They say, I've got this great idea, and it will fix the entire world. It's a great idea. There's nothing wrong with that, but you can't claim it's going to fix the world until you've tried it and put it in production and actually have some experience with it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's easy to come up with a paper design or an idea.
Right. And as usual, as I mentioned, two great nods from the audience and the two guys I mentioned, there's very few and far apart engineering decisions that are all pluses, you know, that have only pluses. They're like, this is good, everything is good.
And what did you say about...
Yeah, you had a much better way of putting it.
Yes, you said it in a much more frank way.
Yes. Well,
something about liar.
Yeah, go ahead and say
it. I know a guy who conceived the design that has only pluses. He's called a liar, you know. That's called a liar.
And so that's what you said on stage, and at the back of the room I said to Scott, or a fool, because he doesn't
right, he doesn't understand,
because
he's
he
wrong.
Doesn't understand his own
liars
products.
Know that they're lying, so
yes, right, that's right.
That's interesting. So one of the other things, not to stay on D for too long, because this is a C++ conference, which is a great thing. So if you look at what Bjarne did for C++ from C was he added a bunch of things that C just didn't have. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned you really liked some of the things you couldn't get in C that you could add to D. But what are some of the fundamental things that C++ doesn't have that D was created to solve? Right? And is it a superset of C++ as C++ is of C? I mean...
Well, syntactically it's not.
Exactly. But
we were actually talking about whether D is a native language, actually. Because, I mean, you don't go down the full-fledged route of required metadata, JIT compilation, although I'm sure there's nothing preventing JIT compilation.
Right.
But you're not, you know, you don't have an IL world by default and that kind of thing, and reflection especially. Mm. But you do have garbage collection, which I know we've talked about, but basically it's a marquee feature. It's on by default. Yes, you can turn it off. You have safety. It's a marquee feature. It's on by default. Yes, you can
it's
turn it off.
It's off by default.
Oh, sorry. You're right. That one is off by default. Mm. But its benefits that are touted are when it's turned on. And so there are some places where D seems to have chosen, okay, efficiency is important to be able to get, but by default we can impose some overheads. Whereas Bjarne really tried to avoid that in C++. And you still have the escape hatches down. So I'm seeing you as D as mostly a native language compared to, say, a managed language like Java. It's maybe 90% of the way closer to the C++ end than the Java end. Is that fair? And have you ever thought about adding metadata and reflection and all those glorious things and hang the runtime cost?
Well, we want to enable them without making them mandatory. So you want to be for the user to be able to add one line, literally one line of code to a class and say, I'm going to reflect this, I'm going to make this class reflection, you know, aware. So, you know, I think D is at heart a compiled language, and it's in the same grand tradition of C++. Mm-hmm. To answer Charles's question, I think D has a lot of new things to say in a few areas. So one is generic programming. I think a lot of things that are possible but essentially they're difficult to the extent that they can be reasonably considered impossible in C++, they're trivial or very easy in D, which makes a lot of things like literally impossible in C++ possible in D. Mm-hmm. I feel there's a lot of progress to be made. I'm trying not to be that liar who says invented the perfect design. So I'm sure there's going to be in a matter of years or decades, there's going to be languages and systems that are going to be even so much better at generic programming than D is. But I do believe that today D has the strongest offering in the area. Then again comes concurrency. And I think D has a very strong offering there that, C++ essentially chose a different path, default sharing and defining a memory model and ruling out by undefined behavior certain programs and such a path which is in sync with the tradition of C, the tradition that was continued by Java, essentially this threads that share memory kind of Buya base, right? And D essentially chose to break with all that tradition and say, you know what, I'm going to go with a route in which by default threads are isolated, mm-hmm. and isolation is done by the type system, not by the hardware, mm-hmm. not by the operating system, which would be much more expensive, and we have a controlled and principled mechanism to share data in a limited manner. So that would be the second offering where D really has a strong word to say.
Kind of like actor-based languages and others also with the isolation route, and then can you get that and efficiency as well?
Right, exactly. So I think D has this combination that, you could have an actor-based language that is not as efficient but has stronger guarantees and whatnot, and D has, navigates that path with panache, I would say, of being at the same time efficient and offering strong abstractions. And third is the data immutability aspect. Which unfortunately C++ is almost there painfully, it's almost there with good conventions. C++'s const is good, mm-hmm. but it must be combined with conventions to be really usable and to provide real guarantees. Indeed, there's a more refined model of immutability where you can actually guarantee that certain data will never, ever, ever mutate. Mm-hmm. I think that enables a variety of things, threading being the main one, mm-hmm. functional style being another one.
So, I mean, what about, and I'm going to point at the man over here because, even though it's not necessarily your language, but what is the notion of, interoperability between C++ and a language like D? Right? How would you think about...
Well, my understanding is that, essentially, if D wants to talk to C++, C++ has no ABI, which is really tough for any language to talk to. So, basically, you communicate through the level of C and C APIs, at least that's my understanding. Which, frankly, I think is a big drawback toward the adoption of D, is that if you have a lot of C++ libraries or whatever you want to be able to call them from D, you can't really do that. At least that's my understanding.
It's close. Essentially, from D, you can actually tap into C++'s object model up to the point of templates. So you can actually call virtual functions from a C++ class. You can instantiate the C++ class.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm.
But it can't be a template, so you can't take the STL. Fortunately, we have our own, but that's another story. But essentially, if we adopted C++ interoperability with C++ templates, mm-hmm. that would have meant integrating a full C++ compiler because templates are so embedded within the language, as is the case for both languages, by the way. Mm-hmm. So they're so embedded within the fabric of the language that essentially, in order to include any true C++ header with templates in it, you would need to include a C++ compiler inside the D compiler, mm-hmm. which would be tenuous. Mm-hmm. But D does interop with C++ at the let's say COM interface level, mm-hmm. so it does obey the same model as COM typical interface based programming, and you can actually instantiate classes.
Okay, but does that extend to so base classes, virtual functions, exceptions, RTTI?
No exceptions, no RTTI.
Okay.
Just straight virtual calls and the basic object model is satisfied. So essentially you can interface D with COM, for example,
Right.
Even though COM is an old technology, that doesn't make it any worse. It's a good technology.
COM's a really old technology, very, very old.
It is an old technology, but it's a solid technology, and it has sort of proven its worth. Mm-hmm. So, you can do that sort of COM style interoperability between D and C++.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So back to, here and now, A lot of what you guys talked about was C++ 11, although I guess we still can't call it that, Herb, because it's
today's the day.
Today's the day.
Well, it takes time for somebody in Geneva to put the pieces of paper together and count up to 40.
Do you think anyone
40 votes.
Today was the day that the international final ballot for the next C++ standard, C++ OX, which... As soon as everybody for sure says yes, which we assume and hope that it's going to be unanimous again, we can call C++ 11, if it's going to be published this year.
Uh-huh. Today's the ballot, started calling it C++ Spinal Tap Edition.
Excellent.
Because it goes to,
to 11.
I should have played more. I missed an opportunity to play Spinal Tap music here as our walk-in music in between sessions. Where were we going with that? Yes, because today is the day the ballot closes, which means, of course, all the countries which have had several months waited until yesterday and today to submit their ballots, because several have emailed me saying, by the way, FYI, we voted yes. Well, that's nice to know. But some did that this afternoon.
Okay. So the deadline syndrome, what you going to do?
That's right. Exactly. Yeah, it's like we don't know about deadline syndrome.
Yeah.
Nervous laughter ensues.
Yeah, exactly. But
so hopefully in the next couple of days, the next few hours, few days, we should know what the actual results of that are, then we'll have a nice standard to celebrate, and probably sooner rather than later start work on the next one. The next ISO C++ standards meeting is actually in a few days. It starts on Monday in Bloomington.
Wow. And can you tell us, I mean, because you actually polled everybody in the audience about what we wanted, and I know that many of us raised our hand for just let it bake for a year and don't start adding a bunch of new stuff. And then I guess 49% of the people were for the other one, which was keep on going, because perhaps you haven't done
enough. Just keep adding more language features.
Adding more language features. Maybe they didn't get the one they really wanted, or et cetera, et cetera. But what are you guys actually going to do next week?
Well, we're going to find out.
Okay.
But I'm sure we're not going to make any decisions next week. It's the first meeting
after we
ship the standard and have been murdering ourselves out for a few years. Yes, it's taken a while, but it's a lot of work by a lot of good people, by hundreds of people, of whom dozens attend, usually 50, 60, every meeting face-to-face, which is not just the official two or three times a year, mostly three times a year over the last decade we've been meeting, but also extra meetings over the last 2.5 years, especially face-to-face meetings, teleconferences, spending extra weeks away in subgroups to get features done, because people put a lot of effort to try to get the standard out at high quality. And I'm really pleased, by the way, because I have this opinion, and I know that the folks in the standards committee, the officers and the subgroup chairs agree, and they've said so publicly and privately, that this standard the first standard was in good shape. The standard is in even better shape
because we
are much less far out in advance of actual compilers this time around as we were in 1998. The features are much more baked and less adventurous. There are a few adventurous ones, but we actually started the whole process by saying, cross our hearts and hope to die that we won't do another export. And we didn't. So it's time for some champagne. But the committee has been very, very smart, very disciplined, very mature, and very hardworking. And without a lot of volunteer effort, we wouldn't be here in getting lambdas done, in getting even features like concepts that didn't quite make it progressed so well that it continues and can be considered again. And a lot of effort went into those things, and I think a lot of people will benefit from standard threading, standard atomics, writing portable code that does more modern things.
Certainly. Now, one question I'd ask Scott and Andre would be, not being on the committee, but being sort of implementers and clearly, rather extreme experts, how are you involved with this process? So, did you make some implementations and say, this isn't really going to work, I think this is a bad idea, or this is a great idea and here's why? I mean, how are you involved as sort of, I would classify as extreme implementers or users? How are you involved with this process?
My role has basically turned out to be that I basically explain things to people. So I'm not on the standardization committee. I've not been on the standardization committee. I don't make any attempt to influence what happens on the standardization committee. I ask a lot of questions and stuff like that. I view my job as looking at the work that the standardization committee does, trying to understand it, and then attempting to explain the implications of that to professional programmers in a way that I think is going to be useful. So, for example, that was the approach I took to the memory consistency model. Anybody who knew about the memory consistency model from a standardization point of view, they would have looked at my presentation, they would have said, that is the weirdest way to explain it in the world, because I didn't even get to the vocabulary until the very end. I didn't talk about happens before until it was almost completely at the end.
I know a little bit about the memory model, and I started off by saying you had a very nice way of presenting it.
It's just a bizarre way to present it.
But give yourself more kudos.
But the thing is, I think for professional programmers, they're less interested in the vocabulary and that kind of stuff. What they want to know is, what are the implications of it? What are the ramifications? Why should I care? What happens if I break the rules? Those kinds of things. So my role, for whatever reason, has sort of turned out to be, I don't try to influence standardization. I try to be one of the people who attempts to explain what they did and often why they did it to other people. And one of the things I wanted to remark on while you're talking about standardization is, I don't think that people who either aren't on the committee, and I'm not, or have not read a lot of the committee documents in detail have any idea how much work it is to, I mean, just the technical work to specify the simplest seeming things. And I was talking to some people actually at this conference, and we talked about delegating constructors, which seems like the simplest possible feature. You have a constructor, it calls another constructor. I mean, really, how complicated can it be? And I said, okay, so as an example, so if you have a constructor, which calls a constructor, which calls a constructor, and then that last constructor runs to completion, and now you start finishing the other constructors, and now an exception gets thrown. Has the object been completely constructed? Because if it has been completely constructed, it means you have to call it the structure automatically. But if it hasn't been completely constructed, you don't call it automatically. And it used to be really easy because there was only one constructor, but now you've got a whole series of them, and one of them has finished, but some of them haven't. And the question has to be answered.
For instance, in that one, philosophically, if you draw the line, just because I happen to know about that feature, if you draw the line that you say, okay, a constructor has finished, at that point you can say, I have a widget object that obeys its invariants.
Right.
However, if you look at the original constructor that was called, I do not have the one that was asked for.
Exactly.
So which is the correct thing to try to destroy? A widget object that is valid or the widget object that actually was required? And that's actually a non-trivial question with consequences.
I mean, arguments could be made either way.
Yeah, and were, at length.
Well, the reason that I bring it up is because it seems like such a simple thing. And, you start reading, I haven't read the documents for that particular feature, but I suspect it went through several revisions with people saying, well, there's these implications and there's these implications. And in the grand scheme of things of the brand new standard, which is basically twice as big as the previous one, this is basically one cross on one T of this enormous thing. So I have been known to say some harsh things about the results of what the standardization committee did, but I have enormous amounts of respect for the people who do the work, because I understand it is backbreaking just technical work, not to mention dealing with all the fact that you're dealing with, 30 or 40 people, and there's some social implications and stuff like that. It's a difficult process.
Now, let me use, that's an excellent example of delegating constructors, because some people would look at what you just said and said, there's several wrong conclusions that could be drawn, which I know you know better, but some people will say, that's an example of how complex C++ is. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it shouldn't take this much discussion. Okay, it's either this or this. You discuss it for half an hour, and you decide and move on. It must be because C++ is so complex and tedious and arcane. Mm-hmm. No, it's a design decision. You have to really think deeply. You go a level deep, and when you're about the 10th, you start to bottom out into understanding the consequences, because what you're doing is exploring paths. And you don't know initially when you're at a fork in the road and you start taking a few steps down this path and there's a few more branches, you can't see around the next corner of the trees until you walk down there and then, did I make it to the clearing? No, I didn't. I backtracked partway and try a different path. Maybe I have to backtrack all the way back and make a different decision. Mm-hmm. Every design choice, every design effort is of that nature. And I had to talk about that at the last C++ and beyond. But so in this case, it's just part, it's not because C++ is broken and weird. Everybody does this. Anders and his team does this for C#. The Java community people do this for Java. Everybody who's worth their salt does this. Now, the other important thing, though, is you look at this and you say, but now Scott's made this. Yeah, it sounds like a simple feature, but now it sounds so complex. But here's the payoff. it is a simple feature to use.
It's unbelievably easy to explain.
Once you made the decision.
If you have gone down the path, you know what the consequences are, and the point of sending the designer down the path is to make sure you pick the path without the landmines.
Mm-hmm.
Once you do that, you barricade off the other paths, everybody just walks through the forest and has a picnic.
Yeah.
Because you just use the feature and that's the way it is, and because the consequences are right. It's the work up front. So it doesn't mean, oh, the language is complex. It doesn't mean, oh, the feature is hard to use. It's just work to make an easy-to-use feature.
Andre likes to talk about forced and unforced errors in language design.
You should say something about that.
Yeah, where you have... Like, so talk about that, because I think it's relevant to this
especially
idea.
Especially with C++, you were saying.
Yeah, I've just been in this odd situation. So, you know, I'm backtracking to Charles' original question. So how have you, Scott and Andre, how have you guys been involved in the C++ 2011 standardization process? So I've been in a sort of an odd position here because participating in a design of another sort of, let's say, complete language, you know, essentially soup to nuts, right? Has opened my eye toward a much, how should I put it, much more tolerant view of other languages' design.
Mm-hmm.
And I have this phrase that Scott likes it, and it looks like it caught on with him, which is, you know, unforced errors. So, you know, in tennis, they talk about this. How many unforced errors does this tennis player make? Meaning it's not because of the opponent's skill. It's just because he or she made a mistake. So I believe there are much fewer unforced errors in language design than most people think. And I'm basing that assessment on experience with designing D, where essentially very many decisions that look awkward at face value. It's like, what were they thinking when they did this crap?
Yes, yes.
Were they thinking?
Yeah. were they thinking at all?
Yep.
Are actually deep, long, and subtle consequences many, many, many steps after, you know, after the fork in the road that came from a primary decision that was very well motivated.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a lot of sense that all of C, C++, and D make in the name of efficiency. There are a lot of sense that they make in the name of efficiency. There's no two ways about that. And there are people for whom the whole efficiency thing does not appear in the equation. They don't think about that particular aspect. And for them, they look at a consequence of the efficient choice, and they're like, I hate this language. For one thing, I became much more tolerant. I'm looking at the committee work, and I'm like, oh, I understand why they did that. I understand, you know, I empathize with them. I understand the flag they're taking. You know, all that stuff. On the other hand, I gotta say, I became much more intransigent on the unforced errors.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
So when I do see an unforced error, I recognize it from 10 miles, and I can say, you know, this is a mistake. You know, this was an unforced error. They did not have to do this particular thing, and they did. There are a few of those, I have to admit. There are a few of those of my own, of Walter's. You know, everybody does them. It's a human thing.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you? Because I want to ask you this, and I might as well ask you now, more over a beer. So I don't know whether to ask you, like, name an unforced error, but because you have an email, I just can't remember offhand what they were. You mentioned, like, there were like two or three, and that was it. I just can't remember what they were. But more importantly, can you name, just to put you on the spot, can you name any things that seemed like errors that now you look at as, no, yeah, that's not, those were not errors after all.
Absolutely.
Like, does anything come to mind?
Bjarne, let me go on record with this. I think Bjarne is a major language designer. I think his original design of C++, in the early 80s, it was simply just a very well engineered language. He made a lot of choices just the right way. And whenever he got adventures, you know, he did make mistakes. I don't think he made a lot of unforced mistakes. So one example would be the handling of const in C++, which is extremely irregular. I'm not sure if many people understand how irregular const is in C++. The way const matches with templates, the way it acts as a sort of a qualifier and storage class at the same time, but particularly the way it acts in overloading. There's a lot of special rules dedicated to const. But when designing this immutability system as an assistant to Walter Bright, essentially we realized that a lot of C++ decisions were actually good engineering decisions. They did not make C++'s const extremely complicated. They made it usable, they made it palatable, and they made it, you know, implementable. So that would be an example of something that may look odd, may look too complicated, may look a bit bizarre if you're a language theorist, but at the end of the day, it's a good engineering decision.
There's a big chasm between, I want to say academe and industry, those are the usual words, but between the ideal and the practical and the pragmatic. And sometimes pragmatic sounds like a bad word. Some people, they think it's one of those words you shouldn't be able to say on television. It's like it's that bad.
Pragmatic.
How you're not pure. You're either pure or you're pragmatic. Mm-hmm. It's not like good, bad. There is bad pragmatic, which is just, you know, just being sloppy. But pragmatic matters. Pragmatic means usable. It means adoptable, implementable. And it means accepting constraints of the real world. And, you know, a big part of design of anything, programming languages, bridges, anything, user interfaces on tablets, is dealing with constraints and living within constraints. Constraints can be of usability, of the hardware, of supply, the supply availability of components, of manufacturability, because you can have a great design, but if you can't set up a production line for it, it ain't going to be good if you want to ship it 2 million people a month. So all those kinds of factors are often overlooked by people who are in sort of a little ivory tower with a beautiful, beautiful design that wouldn't ever actually work at scale and adoptable by non-experts.
The other thing that's really interesting, too, and one of the advantages of being a consultant or basically somebody gets to go and talk to lots of different people, is it broadens your worldview and you begin to realize, everybody tends to make the assumption that everybody else is in an environment similar to the environment that they're in. And so when you go and you visit enough environments, you begin to realize, okay, some people have, you know, build times of 36 hours on a distributed server. There's a company I was at recently, for really legitimate business reasons, they only deploy debug builds, period. That's the end of the discussion. They never strip out any symbols. And the problem they run up into is that they're filling up 4 gigabytes on their machines. But they have really legitimate reasons for only using debug builds. They use no optimization for really good, it's worth a lot of money to them to make those decisions. And most people would not consider that kind of a constraint. And then you've got people working on embedded devices, which has to be unbelievably tiny and really power-sipping. And to try to design something which can satisfy all these different groups of people is a really different problem from just looking at C++ or something like that. And, to me, when I think about pragmatic, I think about, you know, how are you actually going to address the fact that the world is this unbelievably complicated place?
Yes.
And there's lots of people who have very legitimate constraints that they're trying to satisfy. And at the end of the day, a programming language is a tool. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to give them a tool that will help them get their job done. And the best tool in the world is not going to do squat good if they can't use it to try to satisfy their constraints.
I think that kind of thing is especially true of any general purpose language. It's not just in a niche or a vertical. So that's true, you know, Java, C#, Perl, Python.
Yeah.
But it's especially true of C++ and C and Fortran, but especially C and C++, because they're so flexible. And because they're used by such a variety of heterogeneous people. What you just said just set off a whole cascade of things in my head, and I think the couple of most important things are Bjarne saying, and if he says this, nobody else gets to say otherwise, is nobody knows what most C++ programmers do.
I love that statement. Yeah,
it's nobody knows what most C++ programmers do. So if you think you do, you're either smarter than Bjarne, or know 3 million people personally, or maybe just, if we get out more, we may realize that actually there's more than just what we do, because there's probably hundreds of thousands maybe doing what we're doing, but that's a small subset of 3 million.
It also shoots down everybody's favorite argument, which is, well, you know, most people, and yes. You can just stop listening at that point, because no one knows what most people are doing.
And you know, it's interesting when you get into the same as we both do, in my work professionally at Microsoft, in talking to people at conferences and on their own sites, in seeing the different kinds of things that they do. C++ is used in such a wide, wide variety of contexts. Mm-hmm. It's really has legs, and it really shows the prescience that Bjarne had and others who've participated in the design over the years to try not to design for the problem that they think they have in front of them, but say, why shouldn't this be general? It can be efficient. I don't know how this feature is going to be used. I know these use cases, so I know enough to design the feature, but I have no idea what people will do for it. Remember when they learned that templates were Turing complete?
Yeah.
And somebody wrote a little game. I think it was
the
Ulrich.
Prime generator.
I forget his name now, but
Uwe.
Yeah, wrote a. What was his name?
Uwe. I forgot his
Uwe.
Name.
Is it Uwe?
It.
Yeah.
Yes, wrote a prime generator that ran at compile time and output the message as a
the prime numbers as error messages. Yeah.
As a compile error, and it's only gone up or downhill depending from there.
Yeah. So something else that struck me actually, this was a comment that you made, because you know most people think that 4 billion is a pretty reasonable size number. And you were talking at Facebook. It's like, you know, so you'll meet people in the hallway, you kind of bump, and they go, well, so I was setting up a reasonable size set of like 16 billion things, and it's having trouble being initialized. And, you know, most people can't, I can't really conceive of those kinds of numbers.
I can't either. Who can? So I would add a dimension to this, you know, the P word, pragmatism, which is sort of there, but, you know, it's a bit different from the points you made, which is a programming language is human. And I would say humane. It's got to be humane in the sense that people have quirks. Mm-hmm. Human beings have. Now look at our pants. Look at our shoes. Is there any regularity? You know, is there any perfection there in the way you build a good shirt or a good? You know, so people are just irregular.
About our fashion choices.
Yeah, exactly. Like, look at your shoes. So the thing is, people are irregular. And look at natural language, because natural language is very often a good proxy for a programming language, because you know you got to express certain realities in both. I wouldn't take the comparison too far, though, but for the purposes of this point, I think it's a valid comparison. Look at natural language. It has so many quirks. And, you know, the attempt of making the perfect programming language from a purely theoretical standpoint without taking the human quirks, you know, non-orthogonalities, redundancies, you know, there's just a lot of stuff that's got to be in a good programming language that's not theoretically motivated that much. So without this aspect, I think there can't be a good programming language. And the matter of taste and subjectivism comes into play. And you know, I think you got to have good taste to define a good language and a good language feature.
I understand that.
You know, so definitely, this is a pragmatic aspect that is not very theoretically motivated. At the same time, you know, I got to say, as one who has dabbled in theory, in programming language theory for a while, I got to say that theory does have definitely merit that should not be underemphasized.
And okay, absolutely not.
For example, let me give an example from the Java programming language. Java chose covariant arrays. You can define an array, and array of derived can be converted to array of base. Everybody knew this is incorrect. It's not a mistake. Mm-hmm. It's an engineering decision. Mm-hmm. But they understood the positive and negative implications of this decision, mm-hmm. and then they had the theory under
exactly.
You know, they had the theory. They understood the theory, and they made the decision as an engineering decision. So I think this is the best way. You have your taste. You have your good subjective mm-hmm. view on things. You understand the theory, and then you make a decision.
Yeah, because if you don't have I thank you for clarifying that, because the last thing I want to do is compare pragmatism to theoretical, if you don't need to know
them.
The theory.
Right, right.
It's you just can't have one without the other. It's theory tempered with and adapted to the constraints of the real world.
Right.
Because otherwise you do design in ignorance. Because you don't actually know where the path leads if you don't have enough of the underpinnings, or you repeat the mistakes of people before instead of standing on their shoulders,
right.
Which is what we should be doing. And you know, when we were talking about the diversity, the other thing that made me think of is at a conference like this, any group of C++ programmers, especially a lot of world-class programmers here and people who are very experienced, you know, more than two-thirds, more than 10 years of experience, quite a few more than 20 years of experience programming, know a thing or two. They all do different things. And now you come here and you have people who are fairly new as well. Hmm. Such a diverse audience, you will rarely get in with any other kind of programming technology or language. And so a challenge that we have often talked about as we plan these things is what you sort of aim for is that everybody gets something out of it.
Yeah.
That every talk, you basically aim for that 20% of the audience thinks every talk is not useful. 80% do, and it's a, and it's a, and it's a different,
a different 80%.
It's a different 80% for every talk.
Let's wait for the valuations to kick in.
But you know, that's how it worked out last time, and we see it this time as well. So it's but that's part of, like, regardless of whether we succeeded or not, I'm just saying that's what you have to take into account, and what we deliberately did designing it, because there's not going to be, here is the thing 100% of people need to know, except maybe like one or two things like shared putter, or there's a few things that are so common.
Don't return by value.
And lambdas. Okay, anyway. Yes.
But we did have one actually advantage, I think, compared to most conferences. I mean, this is a really small event in the grand scheme of conferences kinds of things, and I have to say that in my experience, the people who come to these kinds of things, these are scary smart people. Which actually is a big advantage from our point of view, in the sense that, you know, they can catch up if they need to.
So, one last question. Are you guys going to do this again, C++ and beyond? And are you also, one of the comments that I was having a conversation with the OpenCL person that you mentioned, and it's not surprising that he would say this, but he wanted things to go even deeper. Mm-hmm. And I know most people during some of these talks
were drowning.
It was clear you were going plenty deep. Yes. As there were glaze going.
There's always the one person who isn't drowning yet, who wants to drown.
Exactly. Yes. So it could be interesting to have, okay, you want a super crazy advance, C++ and way beyond. But seriously, are you going to do this again? This is to continue? I mean, do you want to make an announcement now, or?
The policy, I'm going to speak first and you guys can
go ahead.
We haven't actually officially discussed it. So my policy has been, as long as it's fun and as long as we still want to do it and as long as it's, you know, viable to some degree from a business perspective, you know, then we'll keep doing it. But traditionally, what we do is we do one, and it's only the second time we've done one. So, but we do one, and then we sit back and we say, you know, was that fun? Was it worthwhile? Do we have information we think would be worthwhile for a third one? And then we make a decision at that point. So, you know, I think it's a definite maybe. That's my position.
Mm-hmm. I'm with Scott. I would actually venture an opinion about this event, which has just ended. I'm very happy with the way it went. Mm-hmm. I just skimmed the evaluations, and my perception is that something that I loved, so they're like maximum 5, which is loved it, and minimum would be 1, which I hated it. So
we throw people, those ones away. We don't.
We don't count
them. They're not there.
So most people gave fives and fours.
Wow.
So I was very happy about that. And what I liked the most, and I found very telling, was that people did not give some people. Essentially, they loved everything. They're like, you know, 5 on the vertical, and everybody, you know. But there's a probably the majority of people gave fives and fours to different talks. Mm-hmm. And what I loved
Even
was that
threes.
The distribution was sort of uniform. So some people liked, you know, Herb's teaching the new C++ talk. They rated it the most. And then I got a 4, and other people reversed their scores. Mm-hmm. So essentially, my perception of the skimming of the evaluations was that everybody found something. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something for everybody in it. And what I can say for myself is that I've had a lot of fun. And given that my perception is that the audience had a lot of fun too, and also given that there's so much more stuff to explore in C++ 2011 and beyond, you know, I'm very optimistic about redoing this next year.
Mm-hmm. I'm optimistic about it too. So we still have to find out when, where, how, and whether. But the weather part seems
pretty likely.
Pretty positive.
It's looking like it's likely.
Yeah, because, and you know, one thing that we have been doing, we don't guarantee to do, but we have been doing, is making all brand new talks.
Oh, yeah.
Each time, which is exhausting.
I know. If you didn't redo your C++ AMP talk, I was impressed.
But I drew a little bit from the keynote
but
announcement, but it was a brand new, it was mostly a brand new talk. And so
that's impressive, you guys.
It's a lot of work, but part of that is having something interesting to say, because you've got to be motivated. I mean, that's why I started writing Guru of the Week, which became Exceptional C++, which became whatever. I was doing C++ my day job. I learned something cool. Cool. I want to share it.
Yeah.
Andre does something cool at Facebook with hash tables with 16 billion elements.
And
says,
me.
Well, here's how you really need to write hash functions at scale. Mm-hmm. He wants to tell it. This is... all this stuff is really relevant, and as we as long as we're still doing stuff and we haven't gone off doing other things or retired, there's something interesting to say. You know, that's most of the motivation.
So the one question I would ask, coming in from sort of the outside, and of course, you know, working for a company where we put on giant events, but of course we're, you know, also talking about things that impact lots of people, but blah, blah, blah. There are so many C++ developers, and one thing that we've seen clearly, and I know Herb can attest to this, is when, you know, we talk about the C++ Renaissance at Microsoft, and even walking around meeting all these attendees have been like, wow, you know, got, so thanks for doing more C++ content on Channel 9, on the VC blog. Mm-hmm. It's really nice to see this stuff happening. It seems to me there's a hunger for more of this type of thing, and that it could be a larger event. And so when I was, and I asked Herb and other people to figure out, like, what are the big C++ events? It seems like this is the premier one. And it could so really what I'm trying to ask is, you know, where do these guys go next in 6 months, right?
Good
question. Need to do more, I think, as an industry across the companies that are really large as well, and maybe put on more native-focused events to bring in more people or whatever. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I just want to mention, I mean, another really important C++ focused conference is BoostCon, which is a really well-run conference. They cover really important information, very advanced stuff. But what's sort of interesting, I think, you know, C++ is a mature technology. It's got a lot of users with a lot of experience. And I think, you know, there's basically no published magazines. There has not yet emerged, for example, a really widely referred to website, which is the place to go to really get information. The conferences have largely gone away. So I think there is sort of, you know, people wandering out wondering where can we get this kind of information. But having said that, my experience also is that if you tried to organize a really large event specifically focusing on C++, I'm skeptical that you would be able to draw, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people. I think that the days of that are probably gone. Maybe they'll come back with C++ 11, I don't know. So I mean, I think there is a need for information, and there's a lot of information out there. But I think that sort of the mass appeal, I don't actually see that materializing right now.
I'm hopeful that we'll be seeing more of is that as new technologies come out, that using them with and by C++ is a primary thing, so that at the conferences for those cool new things, you will have tracks and lots of sessions about, and here's how you do this in C++, because that's what people will come to see.
Yeah.
I mean, conferences and magazines are driven by new stuff. Nobody knows yet, and where can I learn this new stuff? Now, to some extent, that applies to C++ 11, because there's all sorts of new stuff there. Now we're going through a wave of having to learn that. But there's always going to be new advances in software and operating systems and environments and form factors, mobile, all this cool stuff going on. And I'm actually optimistic. My educated guess is we're going to be seeing more C++ at conferences like that. Certainly, we know that at Microsoft's next conference next month at Build, there's going to be a lot of C++ focus. And for some of the stuff is, how does this relate to this language? How does this relate to C#? How does this relate to JavaScript? Because all of those are important. And C++ is getting its fair respect again as a first-class important player at that party.
Right.
So I'm hopeful that we're going to see that more spread out, not necessarily only C++-specific events, although I think with C++ 11, there's a lot to be said there.
Absolutely. Well, I know I learned an incredible amount, so thank you for letting me come and do
That's
this,
great.
For example.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. I think it's a tremendous event.
Well, so,
thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Have
Rock
a good night.
Roll, you guys.
All right.
Good luck next week.
Go Native.